Now, a federal lawsuit filed this week by the American Civil Liberties Union is taking aim at the Milwaukee Police Department. The lawsuit accuses the department of carrying out what they call an unconstitutional stop and frisk program that they say disproportionately targets minority residents in the city. The Milwaukee Police Chief Ed Flynn denies the department has ever used such a practice. Here's Chief Flynn's explanation.
Stop and frisk is entirely different than what we're doing. What we've been doing is using lawful traffic enforcement in public spaces to affect the environment.
On a national level, stop and frisk has been a controversial policing practice that critics say unfairly often targets people of color. Some police departments have defended the practice. It was endorsed by President Donald Trump. That said, the use of stop and frisk by New York City police was halted after a federal court ruled that the way they were doing it was unconstitutional back in 2013.
Cami Chavis joins us now. She's a professor of law and director of the criminal justice program at Wake Forest University School of Law. Cami, welcome back.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Well, Cami, before we get going too far, can we define what stop and frisk policies look like?
Yes, so it's very interesting because I think that first thinking about the legal framework of when can you lawfully stop and frisk a citizen is important because what the lawsuit is alleging and what lawsuits across the country have alleged in the past is that these stops are made unlawfully. So to lawfully stop someone, a police officer has to have reasonable suspicion of criminal activity. There are lots of interactions that citizens have with police officers every day that might not be deemed a stop, and that's okay. Those are consensual encounters. That's okay. But when it becomes a stop, when we're thinking about the length of time or the tone the officer is using or the individual's inability to be free to leave, that's a stop, and that requires a reasonable suspicion of criminal activity. In order to then frisk someone, you'd have to have reasonable suspicion of armed danger. And what the lawsuit is alleging is that these stops are being made without that, without those justifications in place.
Who gets to decide what constitutes reasonable suspicion?
Well, so it's interesting in terms of an officer and that the officer's experience receives a great deal of deference from courts because traditionally this would arise when we're thinking about a motion to suppress some evidence maybe that's been found on a suspect, and then the court would look back at the officer and the officer's justification for stopping that individual. What's happening here, though, is that so many people are being, and this is not necessarily just Milwaukee, of course, this practice occurs in many police departments. Most police departments will have some version of this, and will have their own guidelines, internal guidelines, as to what constitutes, the ability, that reasonable suspicion to stop someone. But a lot of these cases aren't adjudicated because nothing's found on the victims of this or on the folks that are stopped. So it's very difficult to say. It's really what has the officer articulated?
Now, we heard Milwaukee's Chief Flynn saying that these are not stop and frisk practices going on in Milwaukee. They are traffic stops. And he goes on further to say that there's a correlation between some reduced nonviolent crime and more traffic stops. What do you make of that argument?
Well, and it's interesting because, and I don't want to, just in terms of getting into the middle of, is this unconstitutional what Milwaukee's doing or not? That's going to be a question for the courts to decide. But I can say that when you are stopping a large number of individuals, whether they're pedestrians or whether they're in their cars, you still have to have some reasonable suspicion to effectuate that stop. You can't just indiscriminately, and that's one of the core principles, really, of the Fourth Amendment, that you can't detain someone for an investigatory reason without this reasonable suspicion of criminal activity. And I think the problem is that this is really kind of been watered down, watering down of reasonable suspicion. And again, the ACLU's lawsuit against the Milwaukee Police Department, one of the allegations is that it's based on racial profiling, that these stops are based on racial profiling. And so, of course, reasonable suspicion for any criminal activity cannot be because you belong to a certain ethnic group. So that's the second part of this lawsuit.
What kinds of markers would a court potentially look at to determine whether there was racial profiling going on?
Well, the numbers here, and again, I'm looking at the numbers from Milwaukee. So over an 8-year period, I guess in 2007, there were 66,000 of these traffic or pedestrian stops. And then in 2015, that number had tripled to 196,000 traffic or pedestrian stops. And so you have many people, and again, the lawsuit that's filed by the ACU makes this clear, many folks are stopped more than one time, right? So multiple times within a year. But when we're thinking about what a court would look at, the numbers are important, these disparities, right? Why would we have so many more African American, Latino folks being stopped in a disproportionate number to where they are as part of the population? Sometimes as you may know, equal protection cases like this is very difficult because the disparities alone can't tell the story. You'd have to kind of prove some discriminatory intent as well.
We're talking right now with Cammie Chavis, professor of law and director of the criminal justice program at Wake Forest University School of Law. And we're talking about stop and frisk practices right now. We're looking at a lawsuit filed by the American Civil Liberties Union against the Milwaukee Police Department, which alleges that the department engages in thousands of illegal stop and frisks targeting African Americans and Latinos every year. And we'll pick up that conversation in just a bit.
We continue our conversation now with Cammie Chavis, professor of law and director of the criminal justice program at Wake Forest University's School of Law, talking about stop and frisk police tactics. A lawsuit filed this week by the American Civil Liberties Union alleges that the Milwaukee Police Department engages in thousands of what they're saying are illegal stop and frisks, often targeting African Americans and Latinos every year.
And Cammie, the ACLU's lawsuit claims that this alleged stop and frisk program has created and deepened public fear of and alienation from the Milwaukee Police Department, particularly among Black and Latino residents. What do we know about the effects of stop and frisk policies, the effect that they have on communities?
Yes, certainly, if you can imagine being a young African American or Latino male, often teenagers or young folks who are walking, going about their business, and then are vigorously, right, are stopped, detained, questioned, their hands are placed on their body, and they're doing nothing wrong. This engenders a lot of distrust within the community. And I don't want to gloss over the fact that Milwaukee has and is suffering from an acute homicide problem, and the majority of victims of homicide in Milwaukee are racial minorities. However, there are a lot of things that we can do to solve that problem, and aggressive police tactics don't have to be one of them. I'm sympathetic to thinking about needing to solve these homicides, but it's a catch-22 because the very people that police officers need the cooperation of in terms of helping to investigate homicides and prevent certain types of violent crime are the same people who feel, based on the lawsuit, who feel victimized by the police. So it's a very delicate situation, and I think that also the ACLU's lawsuit. They're asking for changes within the Milwaukee Police Department, very consistent with changes that we've seen, reforms that we've seen introduced in other jurisdictions, increased transparency in policing, better training and supervision, those types of things.
Now, the New York City Police Department has had the stop and frisk issue come before the courts. What do we know about that specific example and how it might influence or have bearing on what could happen with this Milwaukee ACLU lawsuit?
Well, I think, you know, the facts are of in New York are the facts in New York, and the facts in Milwaukee will be the facts in Milwaukee, and so the court's going to look at that. But I think if you go back to the question that you asked earlier about what do we know about the relationship, the changes, or the damage, quite frankly, that certain practices can do. We definitely see that, and there are lots of examples from New York, lots of oral testimonies from folks, particularly in New York, and I think that there are some in Chicago and as well that have surfaced just about the fear, really, of lots of citizens who may be afraid because their neighborhood is unfortunately not as safe as it should be, but then they don't want to have a partnership or a discussion or relationship with police officers because they fear them as well. So that's the danger that we should be trying and seeking to avoid.
Cammie, what kind of alternatives are there for communities who say this is a high crime area and this kind of tactic, whether it's stop and frisk or some sort of more blanketed enforcement, is the thing that's going to work there? What is the alternative?
There are several things, lots of things that can be done. We hear lots of talk about community policing, right? And I've said before that there's not a police chief in the United States that's going to tell you that they're not implementing community policing. Every police chief is going to say, "Well, we're implementing community policing, and community policing is going to help us with our public safety problem." The only issue with that is that there are many different ways in which many different tenets of community policing that do work, but they're not always being implemented. So I think that the real challenge here is to form those relationships with citizens, allow citizens to set some of the justice priorities within their own communities, and so that there can be this true partnership. But I think that indiscriminately, and I'm not saying that this is happening, but when residents feel that they are indiscriminately stopped, searched, question, and they're not doing anything wrong, that's not going to make a very good partner.
Cammie, thank you so much for joining us again today.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. It's always a pleasure.
That was Cammie Chavis, professor of law and director of the Criminal Justice Program at Wake Forest University School of Law. She joined us to talk about the ACLU's lawsuit against the Milwaukee Police Department, which alleges that the department is engaging in illegal stop and frisk tactics. And we'll continue watching the story as that lawsuit goes forward.
You're listening to Central Time. At one point or another, we've all dealt with a difficult person in our lives. You know the person, the one at work who routinely shoots down your ideas, points out your flaws, or resorts to all kinds of tactics to get his or her way. And it doesn't have to be a coworker; it could be a family, a friend, might even be us. You may have heard that old saying, it takes one to know one, and that's where our next guest comes in. Thanks to something that happened in her life, Sarah Elliston realized she was a difficult person, and it was holding her back. She decided she wanted to change, and now she teaches others how to deal with difficult people. She's written a book full of strategies you can turn to when it comes time to have that important conversation with a difficult person in your life. Sarah Elliston joins us now. She's a teacher, a trainer, and a member of the faculty of the William Glasser Institute. She's the author of the book, Lessons from a Difficult Person, How to Deal with People Like Us. Sarah, thanks so much for joining us today.
Oh, you're welcome. I'm really happy to be here. I'm congratulations on your 100 years. I'm a sustaining member of our national public radio station.
That's WCSU. Fantastic. Thank you so much.
Mm-hmm.
That's great to hear. Well, now, most people, I think, out there will not describe themselves as a difficult person. You had an incident that made you realize that maybe you were. What happened?
Oh, I was really lucky. I had a boss that I really, really liked. I respected her and wanted to have a good relationship with her. So when she told me I was doing something that was driving everyone crazy, I didn't know what she was talking about, but I was willing to listen. And so the funniest part was she said, well, next time you do it, I'll tell you. And so she pointed it out to me at the time, and I still didn't know what she was talking about. She had to explain. I was creating basically a little mini hurricane in the office. I was picking things up and dropping them and stomping around and muttering under my breath. I was trying to find something that I had lost and creating quite a mess. And she had to say, this is what you're doing. Do you see that you're doing it? And I had no awareness of what I was doing or that it had any impact on anybody else. So in the sense that she did it out of kindness, I was very lucky. But I was 50 years old, so I did kind of think, whoa, my goodness, have I been doing this all my life? Has everybody found me difficult? And it was quite an awakening.
Now, I want to, in a minute, dig into that boss's specific advice, because how she did it made a big difference. Let's set
it
that
really
aside
did.
For a moment, though. Mm-hmm. What does it mean, in general, to be a difficult person?
You know, everyone asks me for that. I finally decided to give you a definition. I think it's anybody that we are really annoyed with whom we have repeated contact. As you said, work, family, friendships, relationships at school or in the neighborhood or where we worship. Someone that's really driving us crazy that we think we've done all of the work we can to let go of our negativity around them, and they're still driving us crazy.
And it might be somebody we like and appreciate in many ways, except mm-hmm. that little bit of stuff.
Exactly.
And
there's something that they do that, and it's not just, it's annoying. It has a direct impact on not only us, the family, the clients, the students, the rest of the team, depending on the environment. There has something that you can point to and say, look, this is what, do you know you're doing this? And do you realize it has this impact?
And from your own perspective, and now you've worked with a lot of people on this, the difficult mm-hmm. person doesn't usually know they're difficult, it sounds like.
That's exactly true. I honestly believe that. They're not aware that they're difficult. They may be aware that something is off in a particular relationship. It may feel like that people don't like them, that this whoever they're having difficulty with is just mean. So they may have built up some feelings around that, but they're not aware of what they're doing. Most of us aren't aware of what we do. We know what we think. We know what we feel. We don't pay a lot of attention to physical actions, and we're not really careful about how we speak, is my impression.
I want to get back to that advice from the boss that kind mm-hmm. of turned things around for you. She did it in a particular way, it sounds like. She pointed out the exact behavior that was bothering people, and then she pointed out how it affected people.
Mm-hmm,
can you talk
exactly.
through that a little?
Well, as I said, she was actually giving me some praise and said, by the way, you know, you have this really annoying habit, and I didn't know. And instead of trying to describe it at that point, she said, never mind, I'll just point it out the next time you do it. And a couple of weeks later, I was doing it, and she invited me to come in and sit down and said, do you realize what you're doing? You know how they have those little flippers in offices that are cubicles, those little things that flip up over the shelves? You're
uh-huh.
lifting those up. You're dropping them. You're moving your chair around. You're stomping in and out of the office. You're muttering under your breath. You're getting louder and louder. And we were in a fairly small environment, and I could see that once she pointed out what I was doing, I thought, she's right, I am doing those things. Oh, my goodness. And so I was able to say, I beg your pardon, I won't do it anymore. And I sat down, and I literally sat down and thought about it.
And then part two was kind of the impact, the negative environment it created for everybody there.
Yeah, she talked about creating negative energy. And this was, you know, 20 years ago, and I didn't know anything about negative energy. I'd never heard about energy before. But now I understand what she means. And also that people couldn't, we all did a lot of our work on the phone, or we were, developing projects, writing projects on the computer, and we couldn't think. Other people couldn't think. And so that, and I could clearly see that because it had happened to me when other people had had conversations outside my office. And so I knew what it was like to be distracted by other people's, you know, loud voices or their behavior. And I had no clue. I don't know if all difficult people feel this way, but it didn't occur to me that anybody noticed me at all.
Talking to Sarah Elliston, her new book is Lessons from a Difficult Person, How to Deal with People Like Us. And then, Sarah, a lot of your book is applying this kind of thinking to help people deal with a difficult person. And some of us, how not to. So, you know, broad things like, well, you're just being a jerk all the time, or you're being a baby, or, you know, non-specific reactions like that seem to be singularly unhelpful.
Totally. Absolutely. That's the first thing we have to do. And in the workshops and coaching that I do, it's the first thing I ask. It's like, exactly what does the person say? Exactly what actions are they taking? And often it's like, I just want him to be more sensitive. What did he say? Well, he said this. I said, all right. And that wasn't sensitive. Well, yeah, but I want him to be more. You know, it's just if you can get really specific about the words that are being said and the actions that are being done, it can step you back a little bit from the emotions. When we get around difficult people, honestly, I think we build up, rather than speak to them because we aren't sure how, we build up our resentment. And then, as you know, resentment is just like taking poison and hoping the other person will die. It's just a complete waste of time. So the rest of the book is really a tool, a reference guide of to help the reader explore themselves and their own reactions and how they want to converse with a difficult person, so that when they actually have the conversation, they have clarified a lot of their own resentments and their own whatever it is that annoys them about what the difficult person is doing.
You mentioned
so
the... Oh, I'm sorry to interrupt, but you mentioned the emotional response, and I wanted to get into that. And you talk about trying to separate out from that a little bit, to dial that down, to not let this whole, I guess, halo of emotions and anger get into it, and really try, as you said, to drill down and figure out what are the specific things, how does it make me feel, what could resolve this?
Right. There's a quote that says, take no offense, that which offends you only weakens you. And we are so quick to be offended and outraged, and we work pretty, I think it feels like in our culture right now, we're either, it's either okay or it's awful, and there's no in-between. So to step back and actually look at the words and look at the actions and what the impact is on whatever group you're in, or just you, if it's just you, is the first step. And then, of course, to explore your own emotional reactions. There's a whole series of exercises to do in the book. They're paper and pencil kinds of things, that, and you don't do them really quickly. I mean, you have to, they're thoughtful exercises to explore your own reactions so that you can see yourself as a support person for the difficult person. If there's one thing that I really hope people will remember, is that the habits of supporting and trusting, respecting, encouraging, listening, accepting, that those kinds of habits, negotiating differences, those are the ones that will build relationships. And if the difficult person is someone you have to be with a lot, you really want to be able to build a relationship with them.
But you talked about, you know, controlling our own outrage. If we're assuming we're the non-difficult person, our outrage at the difficult person. Now let's flip it around. We're trying to give them feedback in a constructive way and not trigger their defensiveness and their outrage. How do we do that? Right. So we can't avoid that completely, huh?
Probably not. And part of the exercises in the book is practicing listening. My favorite one is to get with a buddy that knows you. They don't need to know the other person, but what you do is you make a long list of all the ways that they'll react, and it will be emotional, it will be defensive probably, and it will be, denial, and you list all the things that they might say down the side of one page, and on the other side of that page, you list the kinds of things that you could say that would be supportive or encouraging. And the active listening process of, gosh, it sounds like you're feeling whatever the feeling is usually the first step. But you make those two lists, and then you have your buddy read off all the ones in an outraged tone that you expect your difficult person to have, and then you respond and to have a little mini dialogue on each one of those responses, because you want to be prepared for them. Of course they're going to be offended. I was offended probably a number of times in my life, but more offended like, well, who do you think you are trying to tell me what to do? And that was more of my response when people were trying to, quote, correct me or give me what they called constructive criticism. And I don't find criticism in any form constructive. I think feedback about, do you know you're doing this? That's really the question. Do you know you're doing this? Do you know it has this impact? And is that what you want? Those three questions are kind of the goal of the conversation.
We'll leave it there, Sarah. Thank you so much for spending
You're
this
welcome.
Time with us. I appreciate it.
Well, thanks for inviting me. I had a great time.
That's Sarah Elliston. She's a teacher, trainer, and member of the faculty of the William Glasser Institute. We've been talking about her book. It's called Lessons from a Difficult Person, How to Deal with People Like Us.